Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast. This week, The Shire goes there and back again in retrospective LaBeouf biopic Honey Boy, and we speak to its director, Alma Harrell. Plus, a 3-hour Chinese epic that's so long, my son. I'm Jake Cunningham, and joining me to talk about this sweet double bill, the honey-tongued Kelly Powell.
Hello.
The queen bee, Caelan Quinlan.
Hello.
And the positively waspish, Sam Howlett.
Hello.
Hello, everyone. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. Good. How are you?
Yeah, it's all right. It's a little bit chilly.
It's cold, isn't
freezing.
It?
Yeah, it's very, very cold.
How was the weather in Japan, where you've been?
Wet.
Like, really?
Yeah, lots and lots of rain. There was one day of sun where it got to 20 degrees and we were walking in t-shirts, and then the next way it dropped to 4 degrees.
Oh, God.
The environment.
You know,
cool.
Yeah, scary.
Cool weather.
Yeah. But a lovely couple of films to protect ourselves from the weather in at the cinema this week. We'll start with So Long, My Son, which is Wang Xiaoshui's film that explores the impact of China's one-child policy. It spans from the 1980s to the present day, regularly shifting back and forth in time. And it details the changing fortunes of a family and those around them, and just how this government policy has consistently affected their lives across 3 decades. That makes it sound huge, and at 3 hours and 5 minutes, it certainly is so. But as much as it is epic, this is an intimate film as well. How does So Long, My Son do both of those things?
I think, you know, it helps that the film's very elliptical and non-linear. So it will have one scene, and then the next scene, without warning, will skip forward 10 years, and then the scene after that will skip back 20 years.
And there will be no title card.
There will be no warning. There won't be 10 years later or, you know, 2005. There's none of that. It's literally you just have to work out for yourself based on what you've seen before and use your own intuition to pick up on things of what's happened to these characters. And the film, I think, is kind of like a puzzle, not in the way that you have to figure out a mystery or anything. It's just that you have to put one piece in at a time, not in order, until eventually at the end you have a whole picture and you can really see everything from a kind of bird's eye view, because as it happens, you're very much on the ground with these people, not knowing what's happened to them or what's going to happen to them or this and that. So it really gets you involved in the film and makes you really sort of pay attention to it, trying to figure out the order of what's happening to these people.
Yeah,
yeah. Like it draws you in such a way that, like, by the end of it, you are with them. Do you know what I mean? Like, they put you're in the story because you're trying to work it out and you're trying to figure who's what where. And in the beginning, it's a bit of a mystery, what, you know, because obviously something tragic happens near the beginning of the film, and then you're not quite. It skips ahead, and then you're like, what happened? Like, and then by the end of the film, you are so engrossed in the story and these people that you've just completely empathized with them, and it makes their story all the more like heartbreaking and it hits you hard.
I think there are some really interesting cuts that are made that kind of suggest it could go one way, but then actually plays out in another way. So you get this really kind of expansive look at all the various routes and possibilities that life can take in a very kind of like philosophical way, so closely tied to these characters who are just so kind of expressively subtle, I think. Like, there's something really just moving about really slight changes in facial expression that they manage to convey. But there's just this really kind of beautiful maneuvering, I think, of just all the sort of paths that life can take you down. And you think it might be going one way, you think you know them well enough by one point, and you think you're in a certain year, then you realize actually no, we've jumped even further, or we've gone back. So yeah, as you say, you really do have to follow them closely and become so tied to them as characters to know what's going on. But it makes for such a lovely viewing experience.
And it's a really smart storytelling technique to use something like intrigue or mystery when it's not necessarily about that as a story, but they're using that within your edit to hook people so that they are kind of subconsciously getting more invested in these characters because they are having to force themselves to think about this story.
Yeah. And so, speaking of the way it kind of, you know, is so epic and wide-spanning, but also so intimate. So you mentioned in your synopsis the one-child policy. The film is not about the one-child policy at all. The film just has, like, that is a major incident that affects the family of the film in one way. So the film is really good at sort of painting a picture of what Chinese life was like across those 30 years with the one-child policy, with the Cultural Revolution, with all these different factors going on in the background. But ultimately, it's just how those things have slightly affected these people's lives. And as Caitlin was saying, it's put them on one particular path. And it doesn't feel like a overwhelming, sweeping epic. It feels like the most intimate kind of character exploration that you can find.
Yeah, but in the same way, you know, you said something else that it's quite philosophical in its approach. Yet it deals with the mundanity of life, when you can watch someone, you know, go to work and go to the factory and cook, and you're so it has this beautiful way of making you feel like you know, whoa, life's about a little bit more than
it's so visually stunning and compelling as well, like the colors that come out from just even like a bus or like the factory, like there's real like deep greens and like bright yellows at certain points, and it's there's even just like the cameras that they must have used. The cinematography is completely beautiful. You really just sort of like engage with this world in so many ways. So over the course of 3 hours, you're not really feeling that time.
No, it doesn't feel like it at all.
It's almost like reading a really rich novel. It like has that same kind of absolutely. Feel to it. I think
100%. Yeah,
and I'm really interested in the editing of this, because it's obviously a big choice to make this so non-linear, and because so much of this film is rooted in family and memory, I wonder whether that technique is doing more than just breaking up the narrative to keep it spicier for audience, to keep them engaged, to keep them questioning it, whether there's something more interesting it's doing about the way that we link events and that how one thing can inform each other and put us down a certain pathway, but how we will also look back at the way things are connected.
Yeah, and I think the film makes a really bold choice in playing the tragedy that kind of marks the film by playing that scene really early on. And most films would have like hints of what's happened there and build up to it, even through flashback. But this one point blank shows you what happens really, even though there is some intrigue around it, but it point blank shows you basically what has happened there, and then it takes a while to sort of readdress that later on. But when they do bring that scene back every now and then, it is in such a clever relation to the scene that's just preceded it.
And it's from, I think, different people's perspectives.
Yeah, different perspectives.
Yeah. They come back at it, and the memory's different in the way that the audience is told what's happened.
There's a line that the sort of the main, I think it's, I can't remember if it's the mother or the father, but somebody in the main couple says at one point where they say, you know, time's already stopped for us or something along those lines. Yeah. And I think that really is what sums it up, that, you know, I think it's also interesting looking at it in relation to how trauma affects people. And it is that idea of, you know, this trauma has stopped their lives at a moment in time, but everything still has to go on around it. So as you say, it's like coming back to that moment from different perspectives, different angles, different people's memories of it, constantly draws them back, but it also is always related to the world that's still moving and still has to go on. The people that they love and that have, you know, experienced it with them still have to move on and do things. And I think actually what's really interesting, not to kind of spoil too much, but there's a sort of their friends who really struggle to get over the trauma that has in some ways not directly affected them as much as it's directly affected the other couple, but they're the ones that really struggle and that have this constant battle with moving past what's happened to their friends. I think that's really interesting.
It is, And also, going back to the editing, it's such a strong choice to make. It's almost like, yes, time has stopped for the central couple, and their stillness throughout the film is so poignant. And that's also why it takes you a while to work out where you are in what decade, because they're so, even though they've aged, and the makeup is another story, like, it's brilliant in this film.
So subtle
and well done. But, you know, you kind of like, they feel like the same people.
Yes.
You don't see how they've changed in a way, because maybe they haven't.
Yes,
because they've
it's not
stopped.
Something they'll ever get over. You know? Like, they've stopped themselves.
Yeah.
So the performers are Wang Jingcheng and Yong Mei, who both won the Best Actor and Best Actress at Berlin last year.
They're incredible.
They're phenomenal.
Yeah.
So good.
They really carry this film. They're in, they, you know, they go from, across 30 years effortlessly. Some incredible performances.
Well, that one's in cinemas and on home
cinema.
Yeah. So not so easy to take 3 hours plus trailers out of your day sometimes. So stick that one on at home if you want to.
And I was thinking, actually, this is a good one. I think it's talking about just then, it's reminded me that it's very similar for me to Roma. In the way that you have this long passage of time, and in the background you have these events that were happening at the time in Mexico, but the film's not about that. It's about the people right at the front of the action, and the way that life just has these, one little incident can put you down a whole different path, and this idea of sort of getting through that moment. And that's all in Roma, and that's all in here as well.
Mm. All right, what a double bill. All right, so now it's time to move on to our next film. Didn't quite take an all-spark to transform Shia LaBeouf, but he's gradually become one of the most interesting American actors working today, and no more so evident than in Honey Boy. This is directed by Alma Harrell in her first foray into narrative fiction, having previously directed the documentaries Bombay Beach and Love True. Honey Boy is written by Shia LaBeouf whilst he was in rehab and is a retelling of his experience as a child actor, his tumultuous relationship with his father, who LaBeouf actually plays a proxy of here, and his own reconciliation with these experiences. Caitlin, you spoke to Alma Harrell about this one, and we'll talk to her in just a little bit. But I think it's worth getting a little bit of background on all the key collaborators here. Had you seen her documentaries before this?
Yeah, so I've seen Bombay Beach, which is a really interesting documentary about a specific community in this small town in America, quite sort of impoverished communities. But what Harrell does is she kind of depicts their lives set to music in lots of ways. So she uses Bob Dylan and the band Beirut to kind of soundtrack their existences in this really small community. And it's just a very beautiful kind of exploration of how art and music and, you know, lives can be really interwoven. So I'd enjoyed that. And I actually think there are certain elements of Honey Boy that you can really feel that influence in as well. But she'd also made, I think she'd worked on a lot of music videos before and short films. And a lot of that kind of artistry does carry through into Honey Boy, I think.
Yeah, she's a very rhythmically led filmmaker. Love True, her second documentary after Bombay Beach, was produced by Shia LaBeouf. And that's where they... because he had seen Bombay Beach and they got to know each other. And then as part of an exercise in his rehabilitation after drunk driving conviction, LaBeouf's therapeutic process was to write out his trauma from when he was spending time living in a motel with his dad when he was working on Even Stevens. And he then brought that film to Alma Harrell, and that's what we've ended up with Honey Boy. Now, when this was first announced as Shia LaBeouf is writing a film about his own life and he's playing his own dad and Lucas Hedges is playing him, it feels like a prank.
It sounds like a something an SNL version of Shia LaBeouf would do rather than the real thing.
Yeah.
Because he's become such a bizarre, like, figure in the film industry. You know, like, as you say, even Stevens. And then he was in Transformers and he was making his way up the sort of Hollywood ladder. And then he started doing, like, pulling his teeth out on the set of Fury and then wearing a paper bag over his head at the premiere of Nymphomaniac and doing these weird art installations with himself and then, like, filming himself watching all of his films in reverse order. And then he had the hotline where you could call him up to him.
He got very into performance art.
Yeah. But he just became this, like, this sort of figure. And then, obviously, he had his troubles with, addictions and things like that. And so, yeah, this felt like a really strange move. But it sounds like a good one.
Yeah, and I think this is maybe where that strange path has been leading him. Look at what he's been doing in his performance art world, stuff like particularly the All My Movies project, which felt like a very cathartic thing. Like, I loved watching that.
I remember watching him live, watching his films a little bit.
And it was really like when he would watch, like, he might see something in it that, like, reminded him of something and would look really emotional or like a wonderful memory,
something
and the
really
smile
moving
would,
about it.
Yeah,
there was actually. It wasn't a joke anymore.
No,
it was,
I think
someone
he's
reflecting on their life.
I mean, as you say, like, the premise of Honey Boy does sound a bit kind of like, oh god, you know, but I think he must be so aware that set him up as somebody very easy to mock and very easy to kind of, you know, ridicule because of his, you know, the way that he's expressed himself, I guess, and tried to work past these demons. But I think Honey Boy actually is like the culmination of all of that in a way, and it's delivered really, really beautifully. So it all pays off. So when I spoke to Alma Harrell, we discussed her interactions with Shia, and actually their kind of meeting was quite serendipitous, which I think is quite nice. Enjoy Alma Harrell. Alma Harrell, welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So we're here to talk about your film Honey Boy, which was written by Shia LaBeouf and also stars him. I wanted to start by talking about your collaboration with him. I know you worked together on the Sigur Rós music video.
True.
So if you could just explain maybe how you came to work together.
I think it all started when I made my first film, Bombay Beach, which was a documentary, and it won the Tribeca Film Festival and got kind of a small release with Focus Films, and then ended up as a DVD in Amoeba Records in the wrong section. They by mistake put it at the Bob Dylan section of documentaries because it had music by Bob Dylan, even though it was about the Salton Sea in California and people who live there. And Shia ended up picking it up randomly, watched it, and contacted me to my website and said that we should probably meet and try to do something together. And we did meet, and 2 weeks later I think we already did our Sigur Rós music video, which was extremely personal in many ways and kind of dealt with, you know, the perpetuation of drugs and abuse and relationships and all of those things that plague us sometimes. After that, I made my second film, Love True, and I couldn't get financing for it. And he stepped in and ended up financing it and being an executive producer on it. So that was a very generous act. And years later, he got court ordered to go to rehab when he was dealing with his own alcoholism and got diagnosed with PTSD. And while he was there, he was ordered to write his memories, and they came out in the form of a script, really. And he sent it to me from there, and we started going back and forth and discussing it and workshopping it, and I've really felt that should be a film and that he should play his own father. That's how it all kind of started. And here we are now.
And I guess maybe that having that background of quite, you know, a personal relationship between the two of you already, maybe, you know, did that help when you were adapting his own life, his own script? You know, it's one thing to adapt somebody else's writing of a, you know, a fictional story, but somebody's life, you know, did that help, do you think, with the...
Yeah, I think it helped. I think that it takes a certain amount of trust to enter your own trauma while playing, you know, the person you love, but that also is probably...
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
One of the more controversial relationships you had in your own family, and it helped. It had a lot of perspective on what he was going through, and it was, and I was, I think, willing to go through whatever painful process it will yield to make this film. And it was very painful at times, and scary, and, you know, intense, but it was also just one of the most artistic explorations that I've ever had, and the deepest relationships that I've ever had. So I cherish all of it, all that it offered.
Were there any specific lessons that you really felt you took away from this film as a filmmaker, and I guess just as a human?
Wow. I think that really one of the things that I took most from it is I have my own relationship, I guess, with alcoholism, because my father, who I love very much, is an alcoholic, and I've spent a big part of my life trying to understand that relationship and trying to understand addiction, and having a lot of hope for you know, the change, that moment everything changes. The moment that a person would stop drinking and everything is going to be okay is like something that you really wait for as a child. And I think that over the years, growing up and becoming an adult, you understand that certain people are going to have a lifelong struggle, and that you can be part of it as a friend or as an artist or as a family member, while also having a relationship, your own relationship with art, you know, and addiction and all of those things. So it was sort of not a, you know, a simple answer, but I think that it gave me a lot of insight into all of those relationships that have been a part of my life.
Yeah, and I suppose this was your first kind of move into feature-length fiction, or, you know, I suppose you're crossing that boundary again between non-fiction and fiction, but you've worked
in... Yeah, which is something I'm really passionate about, and I feel like really should be sort of approached with less defined lines, you know, in terms of how we look at, in general, documentary and reality and scripted and people and good and bad, and all of those things are kind of very much, I think, fall a lot of times into the cliches of needing to put people in boxes and genres.
I think that's something the film does really well. You know, you can't, there's no clear sort of line that says that, you know, his dad is a bad guy, and there's, it's very kind of treads very delicately, I think, to sort of depict that character really wonderfully. When you're approaching a film as a filmmaker, did, you know, with this one, was there anything you started to do differently? Or do you kind of have the same approach to, you know, music video, documentary? What's the kind of filmmaking process like for you?
I mean, yeah, it's my first scripted film. So I would say, like, I had to learn a lot about how to tackle the beast. But it's definitely not something that I approached by any, you know, book or anything. And I've never went to film school, and I've never really been into this process, so I just approach it in a very personal way, as I do with all my work, like kind of taking it a step at a time and seeing what feels right and very intuitively. Mm-hmm. I didn't storyboard anything other than sequences that needed to have, you know, major visual effects or things like that, yeah. like explosions and car accidents and very ambitious parts of the film that kind of refer to the sets that he was part of. And then in terms of the acting itself, definitely kind of was a combination of rehearsing a lot for weeks and weeks and working with each actor in a method that seemed very right for them. Mm-hmm. Each one of them was different. And Lucas and me worked with a coach that was working through actually dream work. And, you know, the other actors had other things that they wanted to do. So it was very, very intuitive. And each person kind of had his own glove that fitted. Mm-hmm. And then, I think then shooting itself, it was also important for me to have like things that are very stylized or very much come from the world of cinema and mm-hmm. comment on the world of cinema and that he's been part of, but then veer into really letting actors improvise and getting into a room and shooting it and lighting it in a way where you can kind of cover it as if it's a documentary.
Yeah.
So I think the film has both, you know, and like the challenge was how to do that in a seamless way where you can be kind of cinematic and dreamy or you know, comment and meta, a little meta about the whole thing, and then be very truthful and honest and almost feel like you're documenting somebody's memory. And I think we really succeeded in bringing all of those worlds together, which is what I'm most excited about this film.
And I think it's clear in all your work that, you know, music is of great importance to you. And I'm curious as to how you kind of build a musical landscape for a film, or what was the kind of process of coming up with the soundtrack for Honey Boy? And does it, you know, do you go into these projects feeling a certain mood or a tone that you want the music to reflect?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely had a very, very specific mood that I had in mind and like kind of ideas for it, but I wasn't, you know, capable of necessarily expressing it until I got into the room with Alex Somers, who did the music for this, and Zach Shields, my friend, who came in and helped with some of the composing. And the thing that led me the most in this film was a metaphor I had that I worked with all the time, which is of actually Pinocchio, who's okay. like kind of hanging from a marionette.
Yeah.
And really reminded me of all the, you know, harnesses that Shia has been kind of tied to and hanging from. And I wanted to capture some of this, some of these like sounds that come from that world and also the world of the circus that his father, being a rodeo clown, has and a lover of mime, brought into it. So we built a soundscape that was... And a lot of the music, other than the piano and the strings, a lot of the music came from all these sounds we recorded of all these little toys and little cranks and little follies and like things like that. And then finding a way again to blur the line between music and sound, just like actual sound, where you don't know if the sound is coming from the music or from the actual harness that is moving, you know, or things like that. So that was like kind of one of the biggest technical, I guess, explorations we had. And we, I think, managed to do something really special and hope that the soundtrack is going to come out very soon when the film is released.
And I guess just to kind of wrap up, following on from that point a little bit, I think something that I really remember from Bombay Beach is the kind of opening introductions to the people that you're filming. And in a way, you kind of give them their own mini music videos, I think, in the sort of segments at the beginning. And I think there's something really lovely about that, because a lot of people spend their lives thinking, oh, you know, this scene is, it's like happening in a music video. Or, you know, you sit in there, you look out a car window and you feel like you're in a music video. And I wonder if that's kind of how you look at filmmaking, or if that's a philosophy that you kind of adopted, you know, giving these people a chance to just live in a world of kind of music and joy.
I think that It's an interesting question, because I do feel in my own life a lot of times music have been, you know, and I think all of us, like you're saying, we listen to music and then we're sort of feel like we're in our own, you know, musical or music video or film or something like that. I feel that it's important for me sometimes to capture people in the context of music, but also dance and movement, because I just find those things to tell stories and say things that words can't. Mm-hmm. So it's almost just another, you know, paintbrush in I guess my you know, my toolbox, yeah. You could say. And I also feel that people themselves often, like you're saying, or characters, there's a way to capture something of their essence or tell their story in a better way through music than through just another line of dialogue.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you so much for chatting to us.
Of course.
And all the best for the film.
Thank you.
Thank you.
November 8th.
Fantastic. Thank you, Alma. I just want to start by going into the absolute opening of this film, where there is a lot of clapperboards and spinning cameras and chaos. Yep. And I think it's a great injection of how to read this film.
Yeah, I think it really opens with a bang. And for me, I think as somebody who kind of grew up with a show like Even Stevens and has kind of seen Shia LaBeouf move from, yeah, child star into exactly what we've just been talking about through those traumas, there was something that in this opening that immediately connected me back to him and back to a kind of younger version of myself as well, that was sort of, it made me immediately not want to reject him. I was so in the film and kind of, you know, yeah, really kind of tied in a nostalgic way to him and his kind of younger character, which I think really sets this film up nicely, because you're immediately softened to him, and there's no kind of abrasion or rejection of his, you know, his sort of past, you know, your past perceptions of him, I guess.
Yeah, it does. It shows you the grim stuff, the stuff that made headlines, and made him appear in cell blocks.
Yes.
That's all covered within this quite amazing spinning montage at the start. And I mentioned these clapperboards that come up, which we would recognize as the start of a take in a scene, but they show real events here. They appear before that. And to me, that is setting up this kind of dream logic, smashed memory therapy feeling that the whole film is going for, that we will recognize these as events that happen to someone, but we also recognize them as filmed events, that they are something that we witness through screens, whether that's through cinema or whether that's through news footage or anything like that. And that is exactly the experience that LaBeouf is bringing to this as well. He's writing this out not as it happened. He is writing this as a film, and we are constantly reminded of that fact as well. And it's really interesting in those moments when it does play around with bending the reality of it, when we have an older version of a character interacting with a younger version of a character, when people that could not have existed in the same place interact with each other. And it is that idea of, I mean, Rocket Man did this obviously in the most extreme, bizarre, melodramatic way, yeah, with young Elton John at the bottom of a swimming pool talking to old Elton John, who turns into a rocket and flies away. It's not that, no, but it's certainly touching on ideas of trauma and fame in a similar way.
I'm interested in it as a piece of, like, almost his therapy. So to see it, it's interesting that, you know, almost to engage with your own past trauma, you have to dissociate. And it's like peeling back the layers of his past, you know. It's like, this is me, but it isn't me. It's me inside a frame. It's,
yes,
like, it's like
me watching myself
yeah, doing the, yeah, exactly. Mm.
But in it as well.
Yes, like, exactly.
He plays his dad.
Yes.
And he's interacting with Noah Jupe, who plays young Otis. Otis is the name that he adopts for this film. And Otis and James, that's the dad's name, their relationship is amazing in this. Like, you really feel every positive and negative in that as well. Like,
yeah,
the intimacy between them is beautiful. Like, the way that they sync up with each other, like, there is bits of just watching them juggle and the way that they're flipping beanbags between each other and just carrying on a conversation like that. And you can tell just how much time they spent with each other, how much they've learned from each other, like back and forth, but also the pain that they've caused each other as well.
It's so layered, I think, and they both deliver really amazing performances. I think Shia LaBeouf is actually incredible in this film, not only because to take on the role of somebody that has caused you immense pain and immense, you know, trauma in your own life, and to then reenact that, but with such kind of care and sensitivity, I think is really, really kind of profound. And it's there's just something that must have been so difficult, but yes, so cathartic, as we've said, for Shia as a person. But he delivers this really amazing performance, and he never, you know, you can see that his father at times was not a very nice man and had his own troubles and his own demons. But as I said, there's such a kindness to the portrayal of him as well. So you never believe him to be a monster. You just see the layers of this man who's had his own demons as well. And yeah, it's just, I think it's really, really well done. And Noah Jupe is also amazing in this. I think he's so full of energy and just does the kind of, there are certain moments that are clearly like reenactments of Even Stevens or, you know, the types of kids' TV shows that Shia LaBeouf was doing when he was younger. And I think those really show Noah Jupe's kind of skill and his, again, the layering of that performance, you know, understanding that he's mimicking somebody who was probably mimicking other people. And there's that real kind of mimesis throughout that's...
And a... uncartoonish world weariness for a 12-year-old. Like, there are bits where he smashes open a pack of cigarettes and lights one up in front of his dad and like stares him out angrily, and you believe it. Like, it does not look silly. It's really impressive, and their relationship is the core of this film, which in a way makes the stuff with Lucas Hedges playing the more modern Shia a little bit lacking for me. I wonder if that is just because Shia is so impressive in that role as James that you feel him missing in those modern sections. Because I think Hedges, although like that, the idea of Shia LaBeouf in therapy writing this story out should be fascinating.
It's a little repetitive, I think.
Yeah.
And there's only so much you can really dramatize with that. And so, yeah, Lucas Hedges just kind of occupies this section of the film that is returned to, which does, you know, symbolize Shia's time in therapy. But yeah, the scenes are just kind of...
Almost doesn't
it's more like a, it's like a framing device more than...
Yes, and it's kind of going back to it over and over again. It's like you've kind of made the point at a certain stage. So, yeah. Which is a shame because obviously Lucas Hedges is good. And I think towards the end, he comes back into it and sort of has a moment with Shia playing the dad, which... For me, it doesn't quite work in some ways. I think Jake likes
it. Yeah, yeah. I'm a big fan of that, and I wanted more of that, and I wanted this film to collapse in on itself and start bending around its own reality a lot more. And when it did do that, I really enjoyed it.
I think, for me, it went quite meta in a way that I think was slightly heavy-handed, considering the rest of the film had been dealt with so delicately and kind of, I think, had made the points without it needing to go that extra step. But it's still a very, very touching film. With lots of great performances, I think.
Yeah, and also a really lovely score from Alex Summers, who did a really, really good score for Captain Fantastic a few years ago. This one is occupying a similar kind of wavy ambient feel, but it's got these amazing mechanical sounds that ripple through it. Big fan of that and of him. Definitely one for fans of Amharel's films. If you've seen Bombay Beach or Love True, or want to check out what Shia LaBeouf's up to, post-American Honey as well. On home cinema this week is, of course, So Long My Son. So make sure you check that out. There's also a film called Making Waves, The Art of Cinematic Sound, for anyone interested in learning a bit more about the importance of sound within the film world. Certainly one to check out. But that's about it for us this week. If you've got any thoughts on Honey Boy or So Long My Son, let us know by tweeting at Curzon Cinemas, or you can tweet all of us directly. I'm there as at Jake H. Cunningham. Sam, you are
at Sam Howlett _1.
Kelly?
KS _Powell.
And Caitlin?
At CSA Quinlan.
Excellent. And if it's your first time listening to the show and you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe on iTunes, Acast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And whilst you're there, if you could leave us a review or a comment, that'd be absolutely lovely. Now, it's time. We must say so long from us.
So long.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.